You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Kasper Tokuingua, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for the 27th of September. My name is Kasper and I am your host for today, and producing is Christina. E whai a kine, coming up on the show today, Alan Blackman is joining us here in studio to talk science news for our Dare Science segment. I spoke to Dr. Shane Retty from the National Party, as I do each week, this time discussing the possibility of expelling the Russian ambassador to New Zealand.
To kick off Mental Health Awareness Week, I spoke to NetSafe's youth ambassador Andre Faosso about their campaign with Body Right to promote body positivity.
And I had a chat with Catherine Delahunty, the chair of the Coromandel Watchdog of Hauraki, about mining on conservation land. Hey, Fakado, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So, tuku pātui mai, you can text us on 5395, Waiamairane, or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. And also, after the show, you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, Alan. How are we doing today?
Hi, Casper. We're doing not too badly. It's a short week.
You've
got to love short weeks.
How was your long weekend?
The bowls didn't go quite as I planned.
It happens.
1-2 out of 3, but wasn't enough to make the next round. So, yeah, a bit disappointed.
I feel like I do want to talk about bowls, but we don't have the time for that on our segment.
That was nicely done. Wow.
we can do better.
Christina, quite the efficient time saver here.
Yes, indeedy. By crikey. Okay. Well, hell, let's get on with it then. So, right now, folks, right now, even as we speak, the double asteroid redirection test is happening.
And all we can do is think about bowls.
I know, but let's talk about this, because in 7 minutes' time, I believe, there's going to be a car-sized spacecraft which is going to crash into a 160-meter diameter asteroid called Dimorphos at 23,000 kilometers per hour.
Wow.
I know. And this isn't sort of, you know, bad luck. This is actually planned to crash this.
They
car.
Always say that when it goes wrong.
So, thinking back to, oh gosh, it must have been the 90s, I think, or the 2000s, whatever, the noughties, a movie called Armageddon. Did anybody see Armageddon?
I feel like a few months ago when I was doing this show, we did talk about asteroids.
God, did we?
And we did talk about how, maybe briefly, Deep Impact and Armageddon were basically the same movie. And one of them had Bruce Willis in it.
Indeed.
And the other one was shit.
The great Bruce Willis. There
yeah.
we go.
So very scientific.
So so what they did, there was, you know, the Earth was going to come to an end because it was a rogue asteroid and they had to shift it. So they went up and put a nuke on there. So this isn't quite putting a nuke on an asteroid, but they're trying the next best thing. So basically they just want to see what happens if we take something that's traveling really fast. It's relatively small, as I say, about the size of a car. This asteroid's about 150, 60 metres in diameter, so think, you know, football field and a half.
God.
So it's a decent size, but it's moving at 23,000 kilometres an hour, this little spacecraft. So the question is that going to make a difference? Is that going to disrupt the orbit of this thing? Because this asteroid actually orbits around another asteroid, which is called Didymos. And it orbits about 11 hours and 55 minutes. So that's roughly its orbital time. And so what they want to see is, does crashing this into this asteroid make a difference to its orbital motion around its mate? And they're hoping that it's going to make something like about a 10-minute difference in the orbital time. just from the mere fact that it's going to, well, should do anyway, push the asteroid just off its orbital path just a smidge, and that's all it takes. You know, when you're talking about planets and stars and all that sort of stuff, you don't need a big change in direction or in speed to make quite a large difference in orbital motion. So what, as I say, what they're going to do at, it's supposedly 12:14, I believe. This is meant to happen, so in a couple of minutes. And what this DART did was, a couple of weeks ago, it spat out a little toaster-sized satellite. I love the way that's a car and a toaster.
Just for reference.
And this little toaster-sized satellite is going to take a movie of the whole thing.
Oh.
And photos and stuff like that and everything. So
this is what happens when you don't use the metric system. Posters
so
and cars.
Yeah, indeed, yes.
And football fields.
Yes. So probably on the news tonight, I guess, on One News, possibly.
Cheeky plug. very subtle.
Yes.
We're very good at segues today, aren't we?
Very good. Very good. We might see film of this, maybe. Or it might take a couple of days to get back to Earth. Whatever, we shall see. So... and in 4 years' time, which does seem a rather long time, they're going to send up another probe, or it's going to get there, this thing called Hera, and that's going to basically check the size of, the real size of Dimorphos, because, in fact, they don't know the actual real size of it at the moment. You'd think that would be kind of important in working all this stuff out and everything. So in about 4 years' time, we'll get some decent shots of what it looks like. Now, there's always the possibility that it might miss.
That would be, because this was launched in November
it
of
was
last
indeed.
Year.
Yes.
So this has been a long time coming.
It has. If it misses, they do get another shot at it, but not for another 2 years.
Yeah.
So, which seems rather amazing, but when you think about it, it is travelling rather fast.
Even higher stakes than bowls here.
If it misses, yes, yes. You'd be hard-pressed to think that there would be, but, you know, travelling at that sort of speed, it's got to put the brakes on, turn around, and everything, come back, and, you know, it's going to take about 2 years to do that. But hopefully all going well... Cool, 3 minutes to go,
three
folks. We will see.
Put your umbrellas up.
Yeah.
Or prepare for the end of the world.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of picturing, because now that you've mentioned bowls, I've got like
good
a
analogy.
Very specific image in my head of,
yep.
you know, because I played in high school as a joke. This is so off topic, but me and my friends did lawn bowls for a PE class.
Oh, there you go.
And everyone was taking the piss. No one was taking it seriously. And we went to the finals in Auckland because that was our little project to go and compete against the best schools in Auckland or New Zealand in lawn bowls. And St. Peter's, who were the
indeed.
Reigning
St. Peter,
champions
yes.
at the time,
yep, I've got a teacher friend
we...
There.
Just lost to them. They just beat us by like 1 point. I can't remember how they scored. And they
oh,
were furious because we weren't even wearing the uniform. We were just kind of there. And that is not very scientific. I've completely.
Well, my friend is the bowls coach there. So there we go. Small world. Small world.
I'm a little concerned. Has there ever been a situation. Or is there likely to be a situation where we need to divert an asteroid?
Well, just ask the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. yes, you know, very, very possibly. And there was that meteor in, where was it, Chelyabinsk or somewhere in Russia, like how many years ago, where, you know, the amazing video of that. And, you know, that was small, but, boy, it broke a lot of windows and, you know, stuff. So something, apparently something the size of this 160-metre asteroid, if that made it down to Earth, it would obliterate a city.
Well, if only they had this technology in 1998 for the hit movie Armageddon.
Indeed.
Starring Bruce Willis.
Starring Bruce Willis, yes.
Maybe he wouldn't have met a very gory death at the end. Spoiler
Don't
alert.
Give it away. Too late.
It is 24 years old, Alan. I think it is
There'll
fine.
Still be some
we'll edit this
seen
out
it.
Of the podcast.
Anyway, what's our second topic
okay,
for
today? God, she's good. Okay, right. So, being that time of the year when it's almost Nobel Prize time, which is like first week of October, it means that it's time of the year for the Ig Nobel Prizes, which are prizes that are awarded for achievements that first make people laugh and then make them think. And so this is awarded every year at Harvard University in amongst a whole bunch of real-life Nobel laureates. And you might imagine this is sort of tongue-in-cheek stuff, which it kind of is, but then again, as it says, it does make you think. So
sort of like what we're doing here.
Well, hopefully.
I reckon, yeah, we'll get that Ig Nobel next year. You wait, you guys. I'm saying it now.
So there's a bunch of categories for which these are awarded. They seem to change every year. But just to give you some flavour of what was awarded this year. So the engineering prize went to a bunch of Japanese workers. And, you know, this is real research. This is actually real research published in real journals. The optimal way to turn a knob. Okay, so if the knob is 5 centimetres diameter or greater, you need all 5 fingers to turn that knob. If it's 2.5 centimetres to 5 centimetres, then you just get away with the 4 fingers. And if it's 1 centimetre to 2.5 centimetres, then 3 fingers are going to do it.
Are we counting the thumb as a finger here?
Indeed, yes, yes. But you can't turn a 1 centimetre knob with all 5 fingers. That's just crazy. So this is real research. I kid you not. Okay, that's the engineering prize. I kid you not. The physics prize went to workers in China, the UK, Turkey, and the USA. And they were very interested in the time-honoured question, which actually is very relevant right now. Why do ducks swim in a line? Or ducklings. They swim behind their mum and they all swim in a straight line, don't they? Okay, so they studied this. And they found out that it actually saves energy. It's just like drafting in a cycle race.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
And the good old duck at the back, the duckling at the back, gets the most benefit out of all of this because they don't have to do pretty much any work. So there you go. If you always wondered why ducklings swim in single file, that's your answer.
And if you want a boost, go swim behind them.
They have to be big ducks.
Yeah.
The Safety Engineering Prize went to a master's student from Sweden for developing a moose crash test dummy. Now, there are lots, apparently, of moose on the road. Is that the plural of moose? Moose?
That's correct.
Not meese?
We're not getting into this
mooses
today.
No, we won't. We won't. So there's lots of moose on the road in Sweden, and apparently this is quite a common thing that you have collisions with moose. So obviously the car manufacturers want to figure out what would happen if their car was in a collision with a moose. So this master's student spent his master's degree making a rubber and steel moose crash test dummy. And then, I really like this, it says in the abstract to his thesis, 2 modern Saabs and 1 old Volvo were tested. Now, I'd love to see how he managed to actually buy, presumably, a couple of modern Saabs and an old Volvo with his MSc money. They must pay very well.
I was going to say that budget for that study is fascinating. And I don't know if you'd have a lot of people wanting or chomping at the bit to fund a moose crash test dummy.
Well, we do it with asteroids.
Yeah, very good. No, but it's obviously important over there. So, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. And then lastly, but certainly not least, the biology prize goes to workers in Brazil and Colombia. And they answered the time-honored question, how does constipation affect the mating chances of scorpions? Now, who doesn't want to know the answer to that, huh?
So
apparently, a poor old scorpion's got 2 options, okay? Mm. If it gets attacked, it can shed a body part and run away. Or it can sort of fight to the death, basically. So those are its 2 choices, okay? If it sheds the body part, then some of its digestive tract goes with it, and therefore it becomes constipated and it dies of constipation. Okay, so what would you rather do? Just a quick sort of relatively painless death by fighting to the death, or do you want to die of constipation? Those are the 2 choices open to the dear old scorpion, okay?
I've never felt bad for a scorpion before.
I know. But they weren't interested in this. They were interested in what happens to the mating chances while they're suffering from this constipation.
What a study.
Now, as a prize for the Ig Nobel Prizes, you don't get a nice gold medal like you do with the Nobel Prizes. You get a Zimbabwe $10 trillion note. It's a real one.
Wow.
Yeah, they had a bit of inflation there. Back in the day. So so those are the Ig Nobel Prizes.
I have to know, what happens to the mating chances of the scorpions?
Well, apparently they're not enhanced, put it that way. I think if you're dying of constipation, I think that's probably the last thing you're looking to do is to mate. Anyway.
Sounds like humans. I reckon that's
exactly.
Fairly relatable.
Yes. And finally today, getting away from that, so workers at Durham University, and this is really cool, actually. So babies in the womb react to tastes/smells. They actually react to what their mothers eat. And it's often been proposed, I guess, that babies can smell and taste in the womb, but it's never actually been shown. Mm. So this is the first study to show this. And the way that they did it is very, very cool. So they took scans at 32 and 36 weeks, and the mothers were given capsules containing 400 milligrams of either carrot powder or kale powder and nothing else. And then they were given a scan like 30 minutes after that. And so the babies that ate, or the mothers that ate the carrot powder, their babies would give the laughter face response that you could see on the scan. So they actually looked happy. And the babies whose mums had the kale, they gave the cry face response. They looked sad.
I'm curious, why powders and not the actual vegetables?
Probably because you could then regulate the dose, presumably. Just, you know, it's the same as presumably the normal stuff, just easier to take. But so, as I said, this is the first study to show that babies can actually taste and smell in the womb. And you're actually looking at their faces, for goodness sake. So they are thinking, okay, so obviously we are developed to not like kale, obviously. But what they're thinking is that, okay, obviously there are people out there who do like kale, so maybe the fact that they're being exposed to it prior to birth, possibly that might then build up a tolerance to it. They might start liking it or whatever, et cetera, et cetera. So that's sort of the take-home message from this. Also in the fact that babies can smell and taste in the womb. So brilliant. Taking little ultrasound snapshots of smiley-faced babies after the mum's eaten carrots.
And if
brilliant.
You give them home cooking, they fake a smile, which really complicates the science.
Yeah, mum, it's really good. No, but I feel like carrots and kale are just the perfect choices for this kind of study, because I personally feel very strongly about carrots and kale, so this is kind of
you're not a kale fan.
Very representative. Kale tastes like grass, and I'll stick to this one.
Yeah, I think I'd probably agree with you there. Yeah. So obviously, didn't get exposed enough in the womb for. Yeah, I don't think kale was around when I was a kid, anyways.
Wow, thank you, Ellen. For these great pieces, as always, we've had some texters who have been watching the asteroid impact.
And?
Well, it sounds like the signal was lost, but, you know, maybe we'll try again in a couple of years, so hold out for that.
Oh, that sucks.
Or you can watch the miniature version on a moose.
Or you can just listen to Dear Science on BFM. There we go.
Yeah,
thank you to MoTeP.
Yes, thank you, MoTeP.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTeP, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was Dear Science with Alan Blackman, personally the highlight of my week. Do you have any thoughts on scorpions, constipation, mating, the hit 1998 Armageddon film starring Bruce Willis? Tuku Patui Mai, you can flick us a text on 5395. We'll be right back after this.
95BFM presents Diva Mahal, Saturday, November 5th, Winter Garden at the Civic. Having graced stages from the Hollywood Bowl to Carnegie Hall, the incomparable Diva Mahal is back in New Zealand to celebrate the release of her new EP, Future Classic Volume 1 Classic, with her full live band. Just can't call it love. Diva Mahal, Saturday, November 5th, Winter Garden at the Civic. Get your tickets now from divamahal.com. Future sounds from the underground. The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world. Totally Wired. Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future. Next month, even. Some of these tracks are like 2023 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today. Saturdays 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95BFM. Thanks to Flying Out. Flyingout.co.nz. We'll be right back.
you're on your own now. We won't save you. Your rescue squad is too exhausted.
French for instance love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
The National Party put out a press release last week reiterating their call to expel the Russian ambassador Georgy Zhuyev. Foreign Affairs Minister Nanaya Mahuta says the move to expel Zhuyev is under active consideration. For my weekly catch-up with National MP Dr. Shane Retty, we spoke about the potential move to expel the ambassador. I first asked why the National Party believes this should happen.
So we've been expressing a view that the ambassador should have been expelled from about February this year when the decisions that they had made, that Russia had made, became untenable. And we think we need to send a very strong signal that their actions in the Ukraine are completely unacceptable and that the ambassador should be expelled.
What exactly would be gained by this symbolic move in real terms?
In real terms, what it does is it joins some of our other international partners in very emphatically and formally expressing our unhappiness and displeasure with Russia's actions in the Ukraine, and it sends a very strong signal, one of the strongest signals a country can send.
When it comes to the timing of such a move, do you believe that now is the right time to do it? And do you believe it's likely that the government is waiting until some other best time to make this move?
So I can't speak for the timing when this government might decide that it's the signal we need to send. What I can say is in February this year, our foreign affairs spokesperson was calling for the ambassador to be expelled.
How important do you believe it is to keep diplomatic channels open, especially in the possible event of a push for peace?
I think it's very important to maintain diplomatic channels, and we can do that by our presence in the United Nations and through other channels that we have. So I think it's very important that we keep talking, but it's also very important that we send the signal so we can expel the Russian ambassador, and then through our other diplomatic channels, like I say, our presence at the United Nations, we can still be a part of discussions that would be necessary to find a way forward.
How do you believe that Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's comments about nuclear retaliation have changed the equation on issues like this one?
I think this forces everyone's hand. It was already an untenable position for Russia to take, and New Zealand's position on nuclear weapons and nuclear proliferation has been quite clear. And for New Zealanders, this raised, it was already untenable, but this raised an even more abhorrent position for Russia to take.
Do you believe that New Zealand's nuclear-free stance is still tenable in tense times like this? Or is it important more now than ever to have New Zealand's expression on the international stage go this direction?
I think New Zealand's position on non-proliferation and nuclear weapons continues to firm up. Just recently, we had representatives at the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty in New York, and I think New Zealand's position is firming, and was already firming prior to Russians starting to lay this on the table.
Do you believe that this could come into conflict in any way with some of our allies overseas, particularly in times where we want to push for one single unified message?
I think whenever we adopt a position, there'll be some winners and losers amongst our international colleagues, but we strive to be a fair broker and we strive to serve the sovereign right that we are mandated with on behalf of New Zealanders. So it could well be that there are some of our international partners who might choose a different pathway and a different view, but it's our view that New Zealanders are wanting us to express this through these actions.
Are there any other key ways in which a national-led government may have responded differently to Russian aggression in Ukraine from the current government and their response?
We would have expelled the Russian ambassador back in February. We think that line was crossed there, and our foreign affairs spokesperson was very clear then that we should have drawn a line in the sand and expelled the Russian ambassador.
That was Dr. Shane Retty from the National Party talking about the potential expulsion of the Russian ambassador.
I know, Christina, because I really enjoy listening to The Wire.
Oh, my God, I'm shitting myself right now.
Don't shit yourself, Christina. Don't shit yourself.
With Mental Health Awareness Week kicking off, online safety non-profit NetSafe has partnered with Bodyright to promote body positivity and awareness of unrealistic portrayals of the human body in the media. For more on this campaign and the message they're hoping to send, I spoke to Andre Faorso, the Youth Ambassador for NetSafe.
NetSafe and Bodyright. So NetSafe is a organisation and within New Zealand that promotes online safety. It provides a lot of resources for rangatahi and for New Zealanders in general to have safe online interactions. And Bodyright is a campaign that tries to promote body positivity. And basically, Bodyright provides that resource for free to people everywhere, and they can put it on their images to promote unfiltered and unedited images of themselves. And this is in the hope of just creating positive relationships with our body image overall. And so for Mental Health Awareness Week this year for 2022, yeah, NetSafe and Bodyright have come through with a learning resource and a learning module which they're launching in intermediate and high schools in the beginning of 2023 to talk about the unethical retouching of images and filters and the misrepresentation of the human body and how it impacts rangatahi and their mental health and their overall perception of their body. It just serves as a really good learning resource which they're hoping to launch. And also for Mental Health Awareness Week this year, they're asking everyone around the country to share unedited and unfiltered images of themselves under the hashtag #BeYourSelfie.
It sounds like a really interesting campaign. I'd love to go more into what you've mentioned about, I guess, why is it so important that young people are exposed to realistic body standards rather than heavily retouched and edited photos?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, young people are in a very normalized space on social media. Like, this is a part of our lives. It you know, our mornings normally comprise of us picking up our phone. That's the first thing we do. And having, you know, online interactions from the moment we wake up. Definitely from my perspective, I think it's important for us to have an awareness from the onset that we're constantly bombarded with unrealistic images of ourselves and unrealistic representations and expectations of how we're supposed to look. And I think this learning module, it may not be a solution as a whole to educate rangatahi, but I think it's a really good way to turn the corner and just try and educate rangatahi from the onset. Especially that's why it targets high school and intermediate students, just so that as they reach that kind of, like, you know, important aspect of their online relationship or their relationship with social media, it just ought to educate them and give them that understanding that you will be exposed to these unrealistic images and expectations. And it's just a matter of coming to that realization and understanding, but also embracing yourself.
It's kind of a given that teenagers are already overexposed to social media. Does this pose a problem? Is this something that we should actively be addressing?
Well, I mean, I would be I would be a hypocrite if I said that I, you know, am an overuser of social media, because I am, you know. And I think just within my capacity as a youth ambassador, I think I take responsibility for, you know, the others that I know that use social media. And, you know, whenever I hear, you know, my peers or my friends struggling with their online interactions, I always ensure that I'm there to kind of give them that kind of reassurance that what they're seeing ought to be questioned, especially around news and around social media posts and media partnerships and advertising. And I think definitely for young people within this space, because all of these really like obscure things have become very normalized. Even though I'm exposed to them on a daily, I think I ought to recognize them and kind of call them out for what it is. Definitely within this initiative, just calling out the unhealthy aspects and unhealthy images that are promoted on social media, and kind of the bombardment that Angatahi face from it, and just the impacts that it has on us.
Body image issues seems to be a particularly gendered issue, I guess, with young women disproportionately impacted by hyper unrealistic body standards. But would you say that there's some element of young men being impacted by these problems and it kind of going under the radar?
Well, I think from my perspective, you know, I absolutely recognise the struggle that young women have on social media. And from my perspective as a young man, I can already say that, you know, my FYP and my social media feed is constantly bombarded with, you know, like gym talks, or, you know, just kind of like the grind mindset, mm-hmm. where you need to work like 9 to 5 on your body image to try and like get yourself to be happy. And, you know, having that six pack kind of, and the notion that having, you know, a ripped figure with, you know, defined muscles and all that kind of defines your happiness and your success as an individual or as a young man. And in order for you to get attention from yourself on social media, that you kind of need to embody that mindset, but also have that image.
Mm.
And, you know, as someone that has struggled with weight and, you know, with my own image, you know, it is hard. It is hard to kind of face those ideas and those notions on social media. And I think within my capacity as a youth ambassador, but also just as I've evolved with my interactions on social media, I've kind of generated a filter, which I hope that other young men can generate, where social media is a highlights reel. It shows the best parts of ourselves and kind of blocks off the sides that we'd rather ignore and not want people to see. And so for me, I think just keeping that in mind when I have these interactions on social media, but also when I see, you know, my friends having their own battles with their own identity and their own image, and just kind of being there as support, but also just as an open ear and just having an understanding of what they might be going through.
I guess finally to wrap it up, the campaign is about young people taking their own body image, kind of being positive about it, into their own hands. But do you think it's realistic to leave it up to parents as well to play a role in control or influence the behaviours of their children?
I think it's important for... I don't think helicopter parenting is the way to go, especially for rangatahi. You know, this is a saying that, you know, the more strict the parents, the more sneakier the kids are. And I think, you know, just for the sake of online interactions, you know, teenagers today especially are going to have them anyways. And I think instead of parents taking that away from their children, I think it's more important for them to just have an understanding and an element of engagement, just an understanding of the challenges that rangatahi face online, with their body image, with their mental health, and with the different ideas and concepts which they are fronted with online on a daily basis. And I think just the best way for parents to go around that is to just have that understanding, create that dialogue with their child, and have just have healthy conversations about some of the things that they may come across, but also create that non-judgmental space between a parent and child. But obviously, they don't have to hold their hand as they come across these different things online. Just ensure that, you know, they're there, that they're visible, and that they're understanding as well.
That was Andre Farr, also NetSafe's youth ambassador, speaking to me about the NetSafe and Body Right campaign to promote body positivity for rangatahi in Aotearoa.
Project Reclaim is MOTAT's new spring school holiday experience.
Cast as a time traveller from the distant future travelling back to the present day, kids can get stuck into a series of fun, sustainability-focused activities.
Restoring a wasteland to a lush and thriving ecosystem, empowering tamariki to look at what they can do now for a greener tomorrow.
Project Reclaim, Ko'anga, spring holiday experience at MOTAT. October 1st to the 16th. Find out more at motet.nz.
Beamage. Babe, have you thought more about what you want for your birthday?
I already said.
I know.
Do you need the link?
Nah, it's just, you know, you already have a 95 BFM tote, 95 BFM stubbies, 3 95 BFM shirts.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's why I asked for the hat.
95 BFM merch is now at the University of Auckland campus store.
Beamage.
95 BFM hats, hoodies, Beamage. T-shirts, totes and more. Get yours now from the campus store or online at 95bfm.com/merch. Discount with your B card.
Beamish, waiting at the campus store in the quad.
That was The Strokes with You Only Live Once. You're back on The Wire with Christina and Casper.
A members' bill put forward by Green Party MP Eugenie Sage that would have prevented further mining on conservation land has failed without support from the Labour Party. Previous Labour Party policy was to have no new mining, but they have now proposed a review of DOC land instead of an outright prohibition. I spoke to Coromandel Watchdog Chair Catherine Delahunty about the bill, why many believed it to be important, and how it may contradict Labour's promises. I first asked what exactly the bill was and what happened to it.
What a really good question. So this bill was Eugenia Sage from the Greens' bill, which would have banned all new mining activity on conservation land and also help protect species that are in rare areas where there might already be mining consents, because these could then be surrendered if it was going to affect those species. So it was a comprehensive effort, and it's focused on the Crown Minerals Act, which makes it sound weird because that's where the mining permits get issued from. They get issued under the Crown Minerals Act, and the Crown Minerals Act is actually a hideous act that's main purpose is to facilitate mining. But Eugenie's bill would have really, really helped the government honour the promise that they made to ban new mining activity. And so now they've decided not to support it, not even to first reading, where what happens in Parliament is you read it once and then it gets sent to select committee so the public can have their say. So the public aren't even going to have their say, let alone any amendments that, if Labor was so worried, they could have amended. So yeah, we're disgusted and disappointed with the Labor government on this issue.
Why is it important that we pay closer attention to what mining is happening and where?
Well, because since the government made their promise to ban new mining activity, there's been at least 44 more access agreements by DOC to allow mining, plus a lot more permits. And all of the stuff is happening in land that's been set aside for future generations because of its particular value, because of its forest cover, its waters, its species. It's value to the nation. And also for the cultural issues, there's many areas like one in the Coromandel here, Wharekiraupunga, which has many important cultural sites for tangata whenua. So there's lots of reasons why we should not be allowing in the 21st century this stuff to happen. On the West Coast, it's all about coal. Here, it's all about gold. Both of them, Casper, are not needed in the modern world. Coal, we have to transition out of, otherwise we have no climate. Gold, we've got enough above the ground for 400 years and it can be reused infinitely, and we have to stop this.
What kinds of promises exactly have we seen from the Labor government, and how does this decision apparently contradict their policies?
Great question. So in 2014, when National was still the government, Labor released a policy saying that they would have no new mining activity on DOC land if they became government. When they became government, in the speech from the throne, they call it, in 2017, they announced the policy and said, yes, we're standing by, no new mines. Now, they have done nothing about that, instead of which they're doing a review of the DOC lands over the status of different parts of the DOC land that will take years and which will probably result in the miners getting some areas taken out of the DOC estate, particularly on the West Coast, so they can mine them. So there is nothing in this review that's going to help. And Labor are using it as an excuse for not honouring their promise. It's really pathetic, and you have to ask yourself, have they gone inside a free trade agreement that's preventing them from following through on what is a very politically popular policy, which they've announced twice?
On this topic, do you believe that the reasons we've heard from the government for killing the bill are at all valid, or do you think there are other considerations at play that we might not know about?
Yeah, well, that's what I was just saying. I don't believe that any of their arguments are remotely valid. They're just excuses and denials of what they promised. And I think there's several possible reasons for this. One is, I don't know who the environmental leaders are in the Labor front bench. I can't name them. Who are they? No one can name them. I mean, we know that their excuse that while we wait for them to do the stewardship review is bollocks. We know that to go through the RMA, which is what they say is a robust process, is not robust because the Minister of the Environment has called for a fundamental review of it because it doesn't work. So we know that's bollocks. So then we get to the unseen motives, which may be, as I said earlier, maybe that they've gone and signed some free trade agreement, which means that anyone investing in mining has a legitimate expectation. This is how free trade agreements work. If an investor from overseas has an expectation of something, you're not allowed to ban it. So that may be one of the reasons. All of these reasons are highly dubious and ridiculous, except the free trade one. They may have put themselves into a corner without us having any say over it, and we would like to know if that's the case. But overall, I also think that the West Coast lobby, mining lobby, is very strong. There are people in cabinet and ex-Labor MPs who are mining lobbyists, like Clayton Cosgrove. Damien O'Connor will be defending his vote on the West Coast because it's a pro-mining part of the country. And really, the rest of us are being held hostage for these things, and they're not okay. This is not a good reason to mine underneath the habitat of a 200-million-year-old frog in the beautiful forest behind Whangamata. It's not a reason to dig up the Denniston Plateau because there's some coal there. So I don't know how many of your listeners have ever been there, but it's probably one of the most mind-blowing places I've ever been to in this whole country. So really, Casper, they're just failing to honour a promise because they are scared of the consequences. In fact, the consequences could be a greater vote for them. And their two potential future next year coalition partners, Te Pāti Māori and the Greens, have both endorsed this policy, have both sent representatives to our petition presentation 3 weeks ago and said, we stand with this. So here you have it, two political parties both honouring a promise that the other, the government, is failing to honour. It's ridiculous.
With this bill not going forward, what do you believe is the next step for protecting conservation land?
We have to fight this. The bill won't go forward, but we have to keep putting... I believe in... There are several courts. There's the actual court where we're going... Coromandel Watchdog of Hauraki will be going to court over the Whariki Rauponga particular example in the forest behind Whangamata. We'll be going to court within 6 months over this. But also the Court of Public Opinion, because I really have faith that people across Aotearoa do not believe in this strategy of the government, want to see the promise honoured, want to see conservation land. We had in 2010 nearly 40,000 people march down Queen Street, and they were like, you know, no mining on forests, on national parks or conservation land. Like, that was very clear to people. People thought we won then, but no, we're still having to fight that battle. It is really obvious that we have to keep going. It is like being a bunch of ants trying to fight an elephant, a multinational elephant. They have so much money. OceanaGold, which is the main player in the gold world, have more money than we've got. Bathurst Resources, main player in the coal world, may not have so much. But either way, we have to fight the companies. We have to fight on the ground. We have to try and get DOC to show some backbone. And we absolutely have to say to the government, you will lose votes through this policy. So we will be fighting on all fronts, as usual. But we have faith in our communities. We know that this is what people want us to stand up for this, and we will.
That was Coromandel Watchdog of Hauraki Chairperson Catherine Delahunty talking about mining on conservation land. Quote...
That was The Wire.
Ko ire te hotaka katoa mo tene wiki. That brings us to the end of the show for another week. And thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. AUT's Alan Blackman, National MP Dr. Shane Retty, NetSafe's Youth Ambassador Andre Faoso, Coromandel Watchdog Chair Catherine Delahunty. Nera hoki, te mihi, kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and thank you so much for being here with us. Jen will be here very shortly, and we'll be bringing you some great tunes on the 1 to 4. So stay tuned, you're on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.